great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Can you imagine what it must have been like to live in Germany in the 30s and the 40s? We're talking about the true story of a Wisconsin native, Mildred Fish Harnack, and a small group of other resistance women living in Hitler's Germany. Our guest, Jennifer Cheverini, wrote all about it in her new book. It's titled Resistance Women. She's a New York Times bestselling author. She's been on this show a number of times with us, and she's written a number of historical novels, including bestseller Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker. She also writes the Elm Creek Quilt series, and she calls Madison, Wisconsin home. So it's great to have her with us once again. So what do you like about historical fiction? Do you have maybe relatives who lived in Germany before or during the war? What was it like for them? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Jennifer Cheverini, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
In my opinion, I've read all your books, and I think this is your best book. This is a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you very much.
And it was just released and on my birthday, as a matter of fact, May 14th. So most of our listeners haven't had a chance to read it. For those who haven't, can you lay out the story for us a little bit?
Well, it's a novel, so it's fiction, but it's very rooted in history. And it tells the story of a Milwaukee native and University of Wisconsin Madison graduate, Mildred Fish Harnack. And while she was a student at the UW, she fell in love with a German student studying at the university on a Rockefeller scholarship. And they fell in love, and then in 1929, they were reunited in his native country of Germany. And so they were there as fascism was rising and as Hitler was coming to power. And with a number of other friends, Greta Lorch-Kukoff, who another German woman who also was a graduate student at UW-Madison, and then the American ambassador to Germany, Martha Dodd, and then a number of other people that they knew, women and men alike, they were shocked and horrified by the atrocities that they saw happening and observing Hitler and the Nazi Party consolidating power just gradually over time. They became so horrified by what they saw happening to their country that they decided to resist. And they did a lot of military intelligence work. They got secrets from a lot of their very diffuse network of people, and they delivered information to the Americans, but also to the Soviet Union. Their hope was to bring the Nazi regime down from within and saving lives and restoring their country to the land that they had loved.
Yeah, and it's a riveting story. Thinking back as I was reading the book, I read a lot of books about World War II, you know, from the time the war started, but just the buildup and the lead to it, I couldn't recall much of that from my memory. And so the slow buildup of how things developed over time, and I'm sure that those you accurately portray, even though it's a novel, what happened and how Hitler came to power was accurate.
Well, in my historical fiction, I always try to be as historically accurate as I can. I know that when you write a novel, you have a license to do whatever you want. You can make Abraham Lincoln a vampire slayer, you know, and that has been done. But for me, I really do try to hold true to the historical record to the extent possible. There are gaps in the historical record. There are errors in the historical record. But as I'm building a fictional world, especially when I am using actual historical figures as my characters, I do hold to that as much as I absolutely can. My view is, I don't know that this is absolutely the way it happened, especially when we're referring to private conversations that were never recorded, personal feelings that are not written down. But from my historical research, this is the way it could have happened. And I think it's very important what you mentioned. A lot of what we think of as World War II fiction, it starts when America entered the war.
Yeah.
And that is not how it didn't just happen overnight. So I don't really call this a World War II novel, although it does cover World War II. I call it a novel of Nazi Germany because it was a slow, relentless, insidious process of the gradual chipping away of civil rights, of marginalizing particular groups, and the relentless accumulation of power until then, by the time enough people were very, very concerned, it was almost too late to turn it around. But what was interesting about, well, there are many things that were fascinating to me about these women, but something very intriguing was that they recognized very early on that this is wrong. Something terrible is going to happen if we don't intervene. And they did the best they could. Early on, they participated in protests. They spoke out. Other members of the resistance group who were involved in creative pursuits wrote plays, wrote novels, trying to draw attention. But of course, as Hitler acquired power and you could be shot on the streets for failing to give the Hitler salute, the one-armed salute, then of course they had to go underground and really conceal their efforts to fight back.
So you've done such a good job in the book of describing the slow increase in power, Hitler's power, and that insidious the insidious changes that took place, and small changes sometimes over time that it's kind of like the whatever is the fish or the lobster that's in the
frog in the pot of water.
The frog in the pot of water kind of story that really makes for me it made that riveting. And then you in the book itself you sort of devote kind of chapters to the four people that you're highlighting. And mm-hmm. One of them
One of the characters is fictional. I talked about Mildred, the Wisconsin native, and then Greta, a German woman who studied at the UW, and then Martha, who was the American ambassador's daughter. And then there is a fictional character included in my four narrators. And this is a younger woman named Sarah Weitz. And I really would have loved to have used an actual historical figure, but it was very important to me to represent the perspective that Sarah brings to the book. Sarah is a younger woman. She's one of Mildred's students. She's a young Jewish woman who grew up in a wealthy, kind of privileged household, and she experienced personally the seizing of her individual rights, her civil rights. And she saw what happened to her family as laws were changed over time, forbidding her father to work in her profession, forbidding her brother, who was a journalist, to work in his profession, and seeing what was happening to her friends, having to wear the yellow star, all of these things that happened over time. And I couldn't find one individual who would have known the other three narrators and would have been interacting with them. So I made the creative choice to make Sarah as a composite character, drawing upon other real-life young Jewish women who worked in the Red Orchestra, their resistance cell, and in other groups.
What, by the way, when did you first hear of Mildred Fish Harnack?
Oh, I first heard about Mildred quite a few years ago, and it's because my two sons are in the Wisconsin public schools. Yes. Because in Wisconsin, September 16th is known as Mildred Harnack Day in the Wisconsin schools. So I learned about her through that, and also the announcements that were released by the Wisconsin Humanities Council. And I remember seeing one of these announcements online through the Wisconsin Humanities Council, and they had this picture of this lovely woman with a gentle smile. She seemed very kind-hearted.
Yeah.
And then the caption said that she was the only American woman who was executed on Hitler's direct and specific orders. And the juxtaposition of that horrible fate and this lovely, smiling, gentle woman who is who lived in my hometown and went to the UW and enjoyed the Arboretum as I do and Picnic Point as I do. I found that so startling that I needed to learn more about her. So going back to, I probably had the idea to write this novel, I would say, as early as 2014. Mm-hmm. And I actually started writing it and doing my research in earnest in probably January of 2016. So this has been a long process.
And
usually,
here we are 2019.
And here we are 2019, more than 3 years later, and the book is in print. So it's a long process of research and writing.
How did you research the – I mean, did you do a lot of – you must have done a lot of research on Germany in that time period.
Yes, it was essential. And I also did a lot of research about Mildred and Arvid, her husband, when they were here in Wisconsin. And I wrote like three chapters of them here in Madison. But then, and I think this was a good decision, so I'm not faulting for them for this. My editors decided that, you know, we really need to start the action when she goes to Germany. So I have all those chapters that were maybe self-indulgent. I wanted to write about Madison. And those, they're still on my hard drive, but they didn't make it into the book. But yes, I did a lot of research. Martha left a memoir, and she and her brother edited her father, Ambassador Dodd's, letters and journals that he was keeping while he was the ambassador in Berlin. So that was a wonderful resource. We have letters that were preserved that I was able to go back and use. There's a biography of Greta that was very useful that I read. I like primary sources, going back into newspapers. There's so many wonderful period newspapers that are digitized that I was able to read online. And then Greta Lork also wrote a memoir of her experience. It was in German, so I had to give myself a crash course on reading German and then employ Google Translate quite a bit so that I could really get at the heart of what she was saying. And then Wisconsin Public Television also did a wonderful documentary a number of years ago about their resistance circle and focusing on Mildred and Arvid. And you can still watch that online. And they have links to a number of wonderful resources. You can see the letters that they wrote to one another and some of the documents that the Nazis who imprisoned them had. And so you see a lot of these official documents that were filled out relating to their arrest. And those are all wonderful. If you go to Wisconsin Public Television, I think if you look up, you know, use Harnack in the search engine, and you'll come up with a wonderful wealth of materials that helped me very much in the research for this book.
It's a wonderful book. And our wonderful guest here, Jennifer Cheverini, is the author of many books, but her latest is titled Resistance Women. And we'll give you a chance to join in now. If you have some questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Dave Potratz, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Talking today with Jennifer Cheverini, the author of Resistance Women. It's a wonderful book about that focuses on essentially on Mildred Fish Harnack and Arvid Harnack, her husband, and three other women who were living in Germany during the beginnings of the Hitler regime and right up through to the time that Mildred Fish Harnick was executed by direct orders of Hitler. So, again, questions for her, comments, the number to call 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Robert in Middleton will give you a chance. Hi, Robert.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I really admired this woman and what she did back in those days. Her ending was not, as your author surely knows, very, very pretty. As she was discussing the slow, insidious loss of civil liberties, I'm thinking of what we're experiencing today, you know, where the press is the enemy of the people, and there's a boogeyman out there that we all must fight against, and a destruction of the institutions of a society. I think America better wake up. It sounds all very familiar. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for calling. Comment, Jennifer?
I absolutely completely understand Robert's point of view. As I said before, I really started writing this book in earnest in January of 2016, where things were looking quite different than they are today. And I have heard already from a number of readers who have asked me, did this sort of thing really happen in Nazi Germany, or are you enhancing it to make a point about today? And as we discussed earlier, I really do. It's very important to me to get my historical facts straight. And that is what I've done to the best of my ability in this book. If you are seeing parallels to what is happening with the rise of populism around the world today, and what I've written about with the rise of Hitler's regime in Germany, it should give us pause. It should give us reason for concern. I wasn't deliberately trying to draw those parallels when I started writing the book, but throughout the research and writing process, they were inescapable to me. I certainly saw parallels. I saw that they were operating from the same playbook. And it was very troubling to me then. It's very troubling to me now. And there is, of course, that old saying that if you don't learn from history, you are doomed to repeat it. Unfortunately, so is everybody else, even those of us who do try to learn from history. So I think that when we see frightening echoes from history being implemented in our lives today, we do need to pay attention. When in Germany during the 30s, when Mildred and Arvid were trying to build their young marriage and build their lives together, they were witnessing fascism break out in other countries. And everybody thought, oh, well, you know, that's that country. No, that's elsewhere. That could never happen here in Germany. And we have that, we say that, oh, it could never happen here in America. Well, you know, that's what the Germans thought. Of course, our countries are very different. The era is very different. But we should never become complacent when the future of our democracy is the matter in question. It hasn't been around very long in the scheme of human history. Yeah. Our experiment in democracy really is quite young. And it is something that we all need to take pains to, you know, not get complacent if it looks like it's threatened, but to stand up for, stand up when we see groups being marginalized, when we see laws being eroded. Because a lot of the people that Mildred ran into and Mildred lived with, they looked the other way as long as it wasn't affecting them directly. And that is something I think is just absolutely marvelous about this group of people, even though, with the exception of Sarah, of course, they were not being harmed personally themselves. They could not bear to see this happening to other people. They could not bear to see this happening to their country. So they stood up when millions of other people were going along and just kind of trying to, you know, keep a low profile and get through it. And they refused to do that. And a lot of them, of course, they paid the ultimate price for that.
Robert, thank you again for calling. We'll take another call again. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Bill in Milwaukee next. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry. I have a personal memory in that Mildred Harnack was on my mind for many years in sort of a vague way, a hero of Milwaukee and like me with German roots. And I was pretty much unaware. I would read a little bit here and there. And then something stopped me and I realized I had been touched by her life. I was at the Jewish Museum just a few years ago and I saw a picture of her house as a teenager, and that was where I and my wife and son lived for a year or two. And I was just so fascinated by the coincidence that I took a picture of the picture and I started following more closely. But that house is still there. When we lived in it, it was blighted. And when I would walk past it, I would expect it to be gone because it was in such a wreck shape. But it's been taken care of. It's been painted, and the structure looks better. So maybe it can be preserved as a heritage site.
Oh.
Well, that would really be wonderful. I think that in Wisconsin, there have been, especially recently, there have been efforts to memorialize Mildred and her husband. Just recently, a memorial was erected. I think it was just over the winter. I think it's in Marshall Park. I hope I'm not wrong. Maybe someone can verify that fact for me. I can't. I don't recall at this moment, but I think it's in Marshall Park. And then soon after the war, the UW Alumni Magazine put out an article about Mildred.
Nice piece.
It was very informative for my research as well. And then I think there are other efforts to memorialize her in her home city of Milwaukee. But outside of those efforts and outside of Wisconsin, In elsewhere in the United States, for the most part, their story is not known at all or very little. Now, in the former East Germany, of course, Germany has unified since then, but when it was East Germany, the members of this resistance circle, known in English as Red Orchestra, Rote Kapelle in German, and please forgive me my terrible German pronunciation. I have German ancestry too, but I studied other languages in school. In East Germany, they were revered. They were considered just absolute heroes of World War II. There are schools named after them, streets named after them. They were pictured on postage stamps. But after World War II, the United States government unfortunately tried to suppress the story of this resistance network because of the Cold War, because of the Red Scare. The Harnacks and their friends had associations with the Soviets. As I said earlier, they gave information to the U.S. government, but they also gave information to the Soviets. Whatever it took, whoever would listen, they wanted help to bring down the Nazis. After the war, that was considered a very unfortunate connection. And so the U.S. government didn't want that story told. And after the UW Alumni Magazine came out with that article, they were strongly advised not to talk about the Harnacks again. But even so, the UW did, they did keep their memory of her memory alive. But elsewhere, the story was suppressed. And just because of those negative connotations of having associations with communists.
Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, the author of Resistance Women. It's a wonderful book. I really enjoyed reading it. And if you have a question, comment, or maybe an experience to share, you can join in too at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Maybe you can talk. Martha Dodd was interesting.
Yes, she was.
She's a very interesting person. Talk about how she got involved with the resistance.
Well, Martha was a very, very modern young woman for her time.
Yeah,
very vivacious. you don't want to call her a party girl, but she was kind of a party girl. She was also an aspiring writer, an aspiring journalist. She worked as a literary editor for the Chicago Tribune for a little while her father was a history professor at the University of Chicago. And she had heard, like maybe a lot of Americans at the time, she had heard about this movement on the other side of the ocean in Germany, that, you know, the rise of the Nazi Party. And so when her father was appointed by Roosevelt to be the ambassador to Germany, what would turn out to be a very arduous and demanding role, which beyond what he could have possibly have imagined when he went over there, she came over there thinking that the Nazi movement was this young, vigorous, youthful movement of, it was going to revitalize Germany and restore its honor. And she really, she kind of bought the propaganda they were peddling. And so she came over there, and if people said Heil Hitler to her, she said it right back, to the annoyance of her brother and other people around her. So you don't have to do that. You're an American. And, oh, what, you know, hey, when you're in Rome. But it did not. So she went over there fully expecting to be an eyewitness to this breathtaking revolution. But it did not take long for her.
No.
She was no fool. It did not take long for her to see that it was absolutely nothing that she expected. And to her credit, she admitted she was wrong. When confronted with atrocities, she became a very strong opponent and did what she could to assist Mildred and Greta and to get the word out. And in fact, as soon as she came back to the U.S., she wrote a book about her experiences there. It was banned in Germany for obvious reasons, and she had to conceal a lot of names to protect her friends back in Germany. But she wrote very early on a book saying, things are pretty terrible over there. These are horrible people. We need to do something about it. And so for all of her party girl reputation, she was an observer, a good observer of what was happening in that era.
And I think you probably got it right when you said that Mildred, in the book, Mildred becomes quite concerned about this book coming out and wanting
yes,
to read it.
Of course, because, you know, you had to be very, very careful revealing any contacts. And for that reason, although their network was quite vast and it was very diffuse, most of the people in it didn't know anyone outside of their own immediate group. And in fact, unless you were the contact with another small circle in the network. In fact, until they were arrested, it was only then that some people discovered, oh my gosh, my friend, my neighbor, they were in the same group with me and I never knew. And that was to try to, of course, protect the rest of the network should any part of it become compromised. But by that time, Mildred was already, you know, Ambassador Dodd had been replaced. She was already back in the U.S., but she, Martha, was aware. She uses the Nazis' names in her very unflattering portrayals of them. Accurate, though, mm-hmm. It's been corroborated from other sources. But she was very careful about her friends still in Germany. She did not want them to be hurt at all.
And the other, and I don't know how much you want to talk about this part, but Greta Kukoff?
Yes.
Is that the right pronunciation?
I hope so.
What is it about her character that made her fight so hard? And there's an interesting story about Mein Kampf as well.
Oh, yes. Well, Greta was, the Harnack family was really known as the intellectual royalty of Germany. They had so many renowned scholars and theologians and people in government ministries. So they were really considered intellectual and academic elite. And Greta, on the other hand, grew up quite poor in a working class family. Her father made musical instruments and her mother in a factory, and her mother took in sewing and just trying to, she made different articles that were sold in high-end department stores. But Greta was very bright, and her parents absolutely made sure that she got a good education, the best education she could. And so she came from a very different background. She did not come from a background of privilege. And when she came to the U.S., she had a fellowship. She was able to study and work on her graduate degree. When she returned to Germany, she did not have the connections. She did not have the and she was a woman, too. So, of course, it was very difficult. And Germany's economy was in a very, very bad shape. So positions in universities were very difficult to come by. And she struggled financially. And She was very committed to helping. She strongly empathized with people who were marginalized or persecuted. She felt this almost an angry, defiant resolution to do what she could for them, even at her own risk. And when she could not get a position in a university, and she struggled here and there as restrictions were imposed upon women, as well as upon communists, as well as upon Jews, when she found her access to graduate study curtailed, she took in a number of translation jobs. She tried to find work in theater. And at one point, someone who heard that she was very fluent in English as a result of her study overseas, she became involved in creating a translation for British and American audiences of Mein Kampf. And at first she was absolutely horrified. Why would you want anyone to read this horrible book written by this monster? And as was explained to her, there are already translations in English, but they are so censored, so every negative thing, all these terrible things that Hitler said he was going to do are not in those versions. So English speakers and readers have developed a much more positive impression of Hitler than even his own writings created. So they wanted a new English translation to portray what he wrote in all of its horrific, crude accuracy. And so Greta became involved in that secret project to translate the book and get it out of Germany.
And there were some back and forth with the professor who was kind of originally involved in the translation. Do you think that occurred, or did that, where he said, "Oh, we probably should tone this down a little bit," and she said, "No."
Yes, that is something that Greta recorded in her own memoir. That even they wanted to create an accurate version of what Hitler actually said in his own words, translated accurately into English. And when she would translate it directly into English, the Irishman who had hired her to do the project, he said, "Well, you can't say this. This is just too crude." And she would point, "This is how he said it. Let's not clean it up for him. This is how he wrote it. Let's make sure that the readers are seeing what he actually wrote."
And did that book make it out?
It did. They managed to get it was ordered destroyed by the German government, but a carbon copy was made, and they managed to get that out and get it to England, and it was published.
Oh, boy. Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, the book Resistance Women. And before we run out of time here, I do want to mention that you are speaking tonight.
Yes. I'll be at Books & Company in Oconomowoc at 7 p.m. tonight.
So Books & Company in Oconomowoc at 7 p.m. tonight. One other thing that I thought was quite interesting, and we'll go back to Martha Dodd and her parents. They rented their home from a Berlin banker who had a pretty brilliant plan.
Yes, the Panofskys, Mr. Panofsky, he saw what was happening. He was a Jewish man, and throughout their history, they knew when pogroms were coming, and they could sense what was happening. So to help protect his home and to help protect his family, more importantly, he opened up his luxurious house on the Tiergarten to renters, but only one particular renter, Ambassador Dodd and his family. And he made this beautiful, luxurious home. And Ambassador Dodd did not.
For $150 a month.
Yes, very, very cheap. Because, and Ambassador Dodd refused to live up to the luxury of what was expected of an ambassador, because there was a Great Depression going on, and he was not going to spend taxpayer money on lavish accommodations for himself when Americans back home were going without food. So he absolutely wanted this to be as economical as possible. And yet he had the obligations to entertain as an ambassador should. So Mr. Panofsky gave him this extremely low rate for his luxurious home. He moved his own family into the attic, and Ambassador Dodd took the lodgings.
The rest of the home.
Right, because they knew, Mr. Panofsky cleverly realized that the Gestapo, the SS, they were not going to knock down the doors of the American ambassador's house to get to the Jewish family living in the attic. So it was a difficult thing for him to do, of course, and it was a hardship for his family to move from the home that was their home that they earned, and they, you know, they should have been able to live in peacefully. But it was very good, and it did offer him and his family quite sufficient protection. And incidentally, if you'll find more about this in the author's note, but just as a little tease, there is an interesting Madison connection with the Panofskys as well that you can read about. And I'll save that for Madisonians and to read about when they read the book.
Well, it is. I think it's your best book. Books are well written, but this to me is just a absolutely riveting.
Well, one more thing that I really want to emphasize that I found so important and fascinating when I was writing this book is that among all of these people who were involved in their network, they did not have one trained spy. There was not one trained espionage agent. These were not people who were trained by the CIA and sent in to infiltrate Germany. They were teachers, they were writers, they were people involved in the theater community, bureaucrats, laborers. They came from all of these different walks of life. This was not their profession. But when they saw what was happening to the country they love, they all stepped up with their own skills and with their own places in life to do whatever they could to resist fascism. Just ordinary people, but with extraordinary courage, doing whatever they could where they were in their lives to fight back and to not let suffering go on, to alleviate suffering where they could, and to fight back against fascism wherever they could as well.
Knowing that they could pay the ultimate price, and they did.
And many of them did, yes.
Many of them did. Jennifer, thank you so much. Again, you're in Economwalk tonight, and how's the book? It's bestseller in Canada,
right? It is a bestseller in Canada, which I'm so excited about. It was actually released 2 weeks earlier in Canada. They didn't know they were supposed to wait for your birthday. 1 week earlier. So yes, it is a bestseller in Canada, which just absolutely thrills me. I'm really happy about that. So.
And I think it's going to be a bestseller here, too.
Well, that would be great, too. But I think what I really hope is that, you know, more people will be inspired by Mildred and Greta and her friends and their families as I was when I first learned about them, and that they will take inspiration from their lives to resist injustice in wherever they might see it today and in the future.
We'll see you when your next book comes out.
I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you,
A very
Jennifer.
Different book, an Elm Creek Quilts novel.
Yeah, that's probably around Christmas time.
It will be, yes. It's coming out in October.
October. We'll have her back. Jennifer Cheverini. In the meantime, take a look at her book, Resistance Women. William Morrow is the publisher. Copies are going to be available anywhere. Your local bookstore is going to have them for sure. And, of course, they can be ordered. It can be ordered online as well. And if you're in Oconomowoc, 7 o'clock tonight,
I'll be there at Books & Company, one of my very favorite bookstores.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Jennifer Cheverini has written many books. She's a best-selling New York Times best-selling author. Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker is one of them. Fate and Traitors, a novel of John Wilkes Booth, another one. Enchantress of Numbers, which I really enjoyed as well. And, of course, the Elm Creek Quilts series. She'll be back when she has another book, and we'll talk with her again. And we're going to talk about, and those were decisions. Those women made some decisions that resulted in a lot of good, but also led to their death. Do you ever wonder why leaders, they were leaders, even though maybe they didn't consider themselves leaders, they were leaders, and they made some wonderful decisions. And our next author is going to be talking about Why Leaders Make the Decisions They Do. It's another interesting book, and we'll talk with the author next. It's called How Leaders Decide. That next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Miller.